seen the markets hit record high after record high, and we haven't seen some type of bond bubble bursting or equity bubble bursting.
People are sort of wondering, like, where exactly are we? We've been hitting these highs, we've come off a little bit, sort of spinning our wheels a bit, trying to figure out exactly what's going to happen next.
We have no direction being given from our own Federal Reserve, so all we're left to do is to wait and see.
Everything indicates that they're going to hold here. Now, Yellen, we know, generally errs on the side of caution. So Jackson Hole, the tiebreaker is there with her, and the market's acting like Yellen's going to sound dovish.
We have Fed head after Fed head talking about we need to raise rates, we'll look like we're raising rates, etc.
And frankly, when I hear you talk about the Fed rate rates, I wish they'd raise it a quarter already so I don't have to hear you guys talking about it all the time.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, the best thing is most of the major indexes remained in positive territory this week. We had the Dow down slightly, and gold and oil prices on the rise. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Coming up in hour one today, John Kosar from Asbury Research will be joining me on the program. He's a little bit on the cautious side as we head into those dreadful months of September and October. September tends to be one of the worst months out of the year. John is expecting we could see a 6 or 7% correction. You want to hear his reasons why and what he thinks of the longer term prospects of the market. Kurt Wolf will also be joining me. He's very bullish on oil, as we have oil prices on this Friday back at $48 a barrel. Hard to believe it was just down to 40 a couple weeks ago. And Kurt sees some bargains in the oil patch. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here talking about the big events that move the markets this week. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. I don't know if you noticed it or not, but we are in silly season. That's when we have the run-up to the presidential elections in the United States. And believe it or not, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are saying very silly, if not sometimes mean things about each other. There's only just one little problem. Most of what they're silly season debating about has nothing to do with the real issues that are going to confront us over the next 4 years. We would hope there would be some more serious discussion on the Middle East, the war on terror, the deficit and the debt, the state of the economy. Leading economic indicators are slowly rolling over and going down, and why people feel we're headed in the wrong direction, not to mention, by the way, the media lapdogs who tend to promote this type of silliness. So what we're going to do on the big picture today is tell you those things that the media won't. We will discuss those issues that we would hope our presidential candidates could cover, because those are going to be the real issues that will affect everybody in this country over the next 4 years. Ryan Poplava, it's another hot summer week on Wall Street, still within historic norms, by the way, as far as temperatures, despite what some people would like to say. So let's take a look down in sunny San Diego from sunny Coeur d'Alene, as we get the market wrap report. Did we pull you off the beach by any chance? I mean, I don't want to do that. If you'd rather just continue lying there, just forget the market wrap and we'll just go on without you if you need to do that.
Well, yeah, it's been one of those weeks, right, where kind of watching paint dry, you know, on our quote systems here and whatnot. I wish I was at the beach. It's just been gorgeous lately. But, you know, I guess that's why it's so crowded this time of year. But, you know, it definitely reminds me of why I don't leave San Diego much.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's pull things back to Wall Street from Beach Street. What did move the markets this week, even if it wasn't moving very fast? Did it move? It seems like we are today where we were last week.
Yeah, it was a flat week for the S&P 500, but there was movement elsewhere, John, especially if we look at oil in particular, which I talked quite a bit about last week. But this week, the primary conversations revolved around a couple of Fed governors, the Fed minutes, some earnings reports from some of the retailers were pretty good, and some of them actually not so much. Home Depot had good results and increased their guidance for the rest of the year. Cisco beat as well. And then you sprinkle in some of the July and August economic reports. That pretty much summed up what went on this week, but not a lot of it moved the markets.
Ryan, last week you talked about some OPEC and International Energy Agency reports concerning demand, but as I recall, you mentioned that the speculators were mostly jumping on some production freezing rumors.
Right. The catalyst story is the same this week. West Texas Intermediate oil was up 10% on the week based on kind of follow up on those rumors from last week, which was basically that ahead of an Aramco IPO, it's thought that OPEC might do something to kind of prop up oil at their September meeting. So there's been discussion around freezing production, which we've had all year, but also due to weakness in the dollar this week. A lot of that was out of some of the speeches. There was an essay by San Francisco Fed President John Williams, who basically suggested new targets instead of inflation, or maybe use a higher inflation target for when to raise interest rates. He said, let's use these higher goals here rather than 2%. And this, the whole reason for that is, he said, we were kind of in a new normal. When have we ever heard that before? Regarding low interest rates and the effects and how to deal with that, how do economists kind of gauge when it would be a good time to remove that accommodation? I kind of feel like this conversation should have been done, you know, a while ago, like maybe last year before they started raising interest rates. But anyways, he's not even a voting member right now, but that did create some waves in the markets. The dollar was down significantly on Monday when that came out. Not a huge get out of bed significant thing, but it essentially did drop the markets. And we've had quite a trend now in the dollar, which has been down recently. But some other officials came out, like Dudley, that expressed interest in seeing a rate hike again this year at some point. And he said that September was not off the table. And then it's funny, Williams also came out later on in the week and said that basically the same thing, that a rate hike is on the table for this year, and kind of contradicting his essay, because his essay was basically saying lower for longer. But, you know, maybe he didn't anticipate his essay would have the kind of effect it did on the dollar.
What was your interpretation of the Fed Open Market Committee's minutes from the July meeting?
Well, the minutes didn't confirm with a lot of the rate hike talk from Fed presidents this week that maybe even September was on the table. So there was sort of a collective sigh that the markets weren't. There was sort of a collective sigh that the minutes were less hawkish than anticipated, given all of the Fed speak recently this week. So the Fed futures rates, you know, those are rates that traders trade on. Their probability of when we'll see a Fed hike, those are actual contracts, get traded and have some numbers. I actually have a pretty good correlation with, you know, when the Fed actually does hike. You know, we typically see probabilities that are really high. Right now, that probability for September hike is at 18%, so not very high at all. And it's still a coin toss on a December hike towards the end of the year, based on, again, the Fed futures. And that probability is right now at around low 40% for a quarter point hike.
Anything else terribly exciting about the economic or market news this week? This time a year ago, remember, we had a huge volatility from the Chinese revaluing the yuan. So it looks like 2016 is actually taking a break from that. Or, well, maybe it was just pulled forward with the Brexit worries in June and July. And now, you did say, by the way, right, when Jim goes on in vacation, we get a drop in August.
Yeah, typically. It's sort of an inside joke here, but you know, there haven't been any major catalysts to really jar that volatility that happened a year ago. People are not freaking out about the slow economic reports. We've been seeing the reports, like recently the retail sales figures last Friday, the Empire State Manufacturing on Monday wasn't great. But there were a couple that, like in the housing and CPI, which were unchanged, and a few others. I think the Philadelphia Fed survey, which is showing August activity, picked up. But actually, if you look at the details, they weren't that great. Anyways, real mix of economic results this week, but not really anything that moved the market. And if anything, you know, these kind of slow economic results are just continuing to point towards lower for longer, and the market's comfortable with that. Nothing really signaling recession worries like that May jobs report did. The only catalyst I can think, John, ahead that may kind of have an influence on the market is hearing directly from Janet Yellen. She's really the biggest voice on the table of the Fed governors and as the chairwoman. And that will be next Friday at Jackson Hole. So investors will be tuning in definitely for some new language, but expectations seem to be low that we'll see anything, you know, Janet Yellen's typically not someone to really kind of jar the markets. She did in the first couple of years talking about biotech valuations that really moved the markets a couple summers ago. But no, I think many feel the Fed is kind of too uncertain with its plan, and the communication of that plan hasn't been concrete. So the Fed is trying to be at an inflection point on interest rates. They really tried moving in that direction last year with a lot of communication. They finally moved rates in December. But, you know, the world events, the Chinese, the currency valuation adjustments, and all to the strength of the dollar, you know, that has not been helpful to that end. And many times we've talked about on the show, Jim's talked about it, where the Fed essentially has been restricting accommodation through all these measures. Just communicating it about it has adjusted, let alone the dollar specifically for the past 2 years has been extremely strong based on, hey, the Fed is weaning off its accommodation. Everybody else is slamming on the accelerator. So that divergence between the two, it's something we've been talking about for 2 years. You know, that has caused a tightening in and of itself, and has caused adjustments in the market that maybe the Fed didn't anticipate. Anyways, that's really it. Fed next week, Jackson Hole.
Yeah. And as Janet Yellen jets off to Jackson Hole, just north of the Star Valley in Wyoming. One more thing, Ryan.
What's that, John?
Here's the sunscreen. Go back to the beach. All right.
Anyway. Sure, we'll hit this weekend.
Okay. Have a good weekend, Ryan.
You too.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Pavlova or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Kurt Kaluse, author of Exec Spec, a long-running advisory newsletter, joins us today. And Kurt, I want to start off by giving you kudos on a great call that you made when we spoke to you in June. You had said that you thought oil prices were topping out and would likely head down as we neared the fourth quarter. Indeed, looking back, we're now 2 months ahead. It is August 16th, and we have indeed seen that. Oil prices topped out in June, just like you said, and have headed lower. However, they are now picking up. And some are thinking that maybe we're going to see another rebound. So let's get your thoughts on where you think the oil markets are headed and some of the things that you're looking at for your price projections when it comes to oil.
Well, thanks again, Chris, for having me on your show. Oil is an interesting market. I do believe it's a key factor in trying to look at the leading indicators of what's going on these days. Ever since the oil price peaked back in 2014, over $100 a barrel, and falling this year to $26 a barrel in January. Last year, we were looking for a low in that mid-December, mid-February, ideally mid-January period in that area, in a rebound, which we saw. And then we had a setback here from $52 a barrel or so on the October contract down into the upper 30s. From there, we have rallied, as you said, back into the upper 40s here, $46, $47 a barrel today. A lot of that, I believe, is predicated upon the rumors, once again, of Saudi Arabia and Russia leading the charge for OPEC production cuts and stimulating a bit of anxiety there about higher prices and shortages, drawing down those huge excess inventories that we have in oil out there. I do believe that most likely this is temporary and unlikely to hold. The logic of the Sauds being able to sustain higher prices with production cuts means that they'll just be handing over market share to other producers outside of OPEC. It will also cause frackers to come back online and more substitution by other countries in other areas of energy. So the idea of this Thursday meeting, alleged meeting between Russia and Saudi Arabia, generating realistic production cuts that can sustain higher prices seems a bit chimerical, but we will just wait to see how that manifests. The bottom line is that typically, we have a seasonal rally in prices in the second quarter. They're peaking around that May, June, July time period. So I was looking for that pullback, and we have a typical summer inventory drawdown throughout the summer into, say, August, September, maybe October timeframe. So that is already coming to an end. But last year, we saw a sharper seasonal drawdown in the inventory stockpiles of oil. This year, we're seeing a smaller drop in that surplus oil. Inventories are still well above the peak levels of last year. And the idea that we're running into a period where typically inventories will be building more as we move into the fourth quarter into early 2017 doesn't bode well for prices being sustained up here. So while there's always the chance that prices could rise back to its recent highs in the low 50s, the odds favor still more price deterioration, perhaps into the 30s once again, as the year unfolds. So I think we're still stuck in a trading range. And certainly a red flag would appear if we were to get down towards Gary Shiller's levels way below $26 a barrel, where junk bond yields would soar and that sort of thing, and the economy would be weak, because oil is sort of a leading indicator to look at on a very simplistic basis. And the supply-demand situation is still not good, with inventories unable to be worked off until much later in 2017, perhaps 2018, before we can see a more solid base to move up from.
Well, after Brexit, just the opposite happened. Stocks took off. That old adage, sell and may go away, has not played out this summer. Joining me on the program is John Kosar from Asbury Research. John, let's talk about where the market is. As I'm looking over the last week, we've got the Dow slightly negative, the S&P flat, but the smaller cap stocks are still in positive territory. What's your take on the market here going forward, and especially as we head into the fall? As we know, typically in September and October, we tend to get turbulence.
We came out second week of July and told clients, we have a lot of financial advisor clients, that were wondering whether they should put some new money to work. And we've been advising against that, and we still feel that way. Actually, before I got on the phone with you, I checked, and on July 14th, to now in the S&P 500, the S&P is only up 0.8%. So far that has worked out well. I still feel the same way. I don't want to put any new money to work. I've been telling clients to ratchet their stops up. I think we get a sell-off, let's call it. I think it's going to be, ideally, in order to keep our more positive 1-2 quarter outlook solid, it should be in the 4-6-7% range in terms of this pullback that I'm expecting. There's a few factors here, but one of the main reasons that I am looking for it is the market is way too complacent. VIX has been hovering around 12 for weeks. And if you look at a chart, go back several years and see what the S&P 500 does when the VIX is at 12. It's not a timing tool. It doesn't tell you sell all my stocks right now, but it has been a very good indication of don't chase new highs. Don't be pressing the long side. Don't be putting any new money to work, because it's like putting a stone around, you know, the market's neck. It just has a really hard time trying to keep moving forward, keeping its head up. Put call ratios very low. Nobody's buying insurance. Everybody's fat and happy. That's typically when bad things happen. So that's been our tack for just a little bit over a month now, and we still have that.
Could we see, as we've seen in the past, where right now the Dow is stalling, we've seen utilities stall, even consumer staples, those were the safety trade. We're seeing the smaller cap indexes doing very well. Could that flip as we get into the fall?
Yes. Very simplistically, when the market is worry-free, when it's happy, when the VIX is low, investors are willing to take a little more risk. So they're willing to buy small cap stocks. They're willing to buy semis. The last time I was on back in June, I talked about a buying opportunity in the semis. And the semis have actually outperformed the S&P by 7-8% just in that short time since we spoke last. That indicates appetite for risk. Those are the usual suspects. If you think the market's going to go higher, those are the places you want to be. you know, those are the faster horses, so to speak. But it's a double-edged sword when the market gets nervous. When you get a spike in the VIX, when put-call ratios start to jump, when something happens to make people apprehensive, the opposite happens. All of those fast horses are the first ones to fall off the track. So, yes, that's exactly what I think is going to happen here between now and the end of the quarter. Those faster horses that have outperformed so well for us this summer are going to fall out of favor first and probably get hit the hardest.
John, what is it about September and October in the markets that typically we see corrections? Sometimes they're small, sometimes they're big. And I guess that would be my first question. The second one would be, how does the market perform in a presidential election year, especially as you head into the fall where, you know, the pundits are saying don't take the polls seriously until, you know, after Labor Day, because then the polls tend to tighten and the markets start to pay attention because the market has been one of the best predictors of the next president.
The election year, statistically, as I recall, it's better performing than in non-election years. I focus on, you know, the standard seasonality charts. Our data goes back to March of 57, which is when the S&P 500 evolved into its current iteration, its current format. You know, your question is, why does that happen in September? I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of different answers to that, and I don't know if there's any way to prove exactly why that happens. What I'm interested in, though, is statistics. Statistically, it does happen. And not only is September the weakest month of the year, I don't have the chart in front of me, but we also, our seasonality charts show, you know, the average percentage higher or lower for the month, and they also show the average percentage closes higher or lower. And I know September is not only the weakest month in terms of how deep the sell-off, but it's also the weakest month in terms of how many of those months have been negative. So it happens. It happens frequently. And the way I look at seasonality is, you can't look at seasonality as an independent indicator. Okay, seasonal tell me to do this, I'm going to do this. What I use them as is kind of an overlay. I watch the first 3 to 4 to 5 months and see if it's going to be a quote-unquote seasonal year, see if the market's tracking seasonals. It has this year. Second thing I look at, are there other supporting factors other than just seasonality that tells me we're going to get a rally here or we're going to get a break here? And right now, again, the market is really complacent. You could see it in put calls. You could see it in volatility. Both of the NASDAQ indexes, the comp and the NDX, the latter, which is the 100, they are both bumping up against their top of the tech bubble highs that they made back in March of 2000. So you got this big overhang up above a segment of the market that typically leads, which is tech. The market is fat and happy. It isn't expecting any problems. Volatility is low. Now you overlay seasonality over that, and now you've got something to hang your hat on. So that's kind of how I look at that. I don't know if I hit all of your things that you asked, but hopefully I did.
Have you ever looked at why the market does what it does every September, October? I mean, it's fairly predictable in terms of seasonalities, although, you know, some of the seasonalities we typically get, sell and may go away, haven't played out. I mean, we've had a very, very strong rally following the Brexit vote.
Well, I think what happens is people say, well, it's June or it's July and we haven't sold off, so sell in May and go away doesn't work. I mean, you know, I've heard the people on CNBC vacillate from month to month where either seasonality is like, you know, the golden oracle from up above, or it's an old wives' tale, depending on what it does that week. I think when you look at seasonality, sometimes you have to look at the general pattern, because, you know what, if you're sitting here in August and we're at all-time highs, you're like, this really doesn't work. But let's see what happens in September. If we have a 6 to 7% pullback between now and the first part of the fourth quarter, and then you look at the yearly chart, people may look at this and say, you know what, this worked pretty well. I mean, it overextended a little bit in August, but it worked pretty well. So I think sometimes when you're right inside of that May to September period, you know, it feels like it's not working. But when people look at seasonality, they don't generally look at it inside of that segment. They look at it at the end of the year, you know. So I think it's a little too early to make that determination, I guess, is where I'm going with that.
In terms of this pullback, you know, it seems like there's been predictions of crashes, there's been predictions of a bear market, but I don't know about you, John. I'm looking at a government bond screen. I'm looking at two-year treasuries that are a little over 0.7%. You're looking at the 10-year at roughly a little over 1.5%. And as low as that seems, then you look at two-year bonds in Germany, 10-year notes in Germany, they're negative. You've got negative rates on short-term Italian debt, Japanese debt, Spain. I mean, where do investors go? And is this one of the reasons why some of these safety trades like the acronym STUB, you know, staples, telecom, utilities, and bonds have done so well this year?
It's been a tough year. I mean, just kind of a little more broadly, if I'm kind of getting your point, the S&P 500 has been flat for a year to 18 months. I have metrics here in-house that I built, you know, to track sector rotation. As you know, it looks at asset flows and the sector spider ETFs. That segment has been flat as well. I think there was no alpha to be had in, you know, the broad markets. So there was maybe more activity going into the sector space. The rotation has been much faster. Our indicators are set up on sectors to work to the quarter. So we're trying to catch a 3 to 6 month move. The sector rotation this year has been 4 to 6 to 8 weeks and maybe 3 to 5%, you know, before it starts to go back. So there's not a lot happening there too. So what it's forced me to do is make a lot more individual stock picks, individual ETF picks. So I've been kind of trying to go somewhere to find some alpha. And some of the places that we found that, the last time I was on, I talked about steel, the steel ETF, SLX. You know, that looked like a buy. It's up 20% from when I was on last, which is a couple of months ago. Now, we've since cashed out of that idea. But where I'm going with that is, I think there's ideas in the individual stock space. I mentioned Texas Instruments last time I was on. You know, that's done really well. Some of the commodities, metals and mining, we've been in and out of 3 times this year. XME, it's the metals and mining ETF. So there are opportunities out there, but you got to dig for them.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we've seen coming out of the, let's say, February lows. We've seen a broad-based rally in the commodity stocks. It's not just been oil and gold, although they've retreated lately, but it was across the spectrum. You saw it in other commodities as well. Does that tell you anything, or do you think this is just a trade from extremely oversold conditions?
No, I don't. Actually, that jogged my memory. You and I talked about this at least the last time I was on, maybe the last two. If you remember the first quarter, I saw you turn on CNBC, which is, I mean, you know, I'm from the trading floor. You know, I started my time in the business there 30 years ago. I don't have the floor to listen to anymore. So now I listen to CNBC for chatter. It tells me, you know, what the buzz is, what the market's thinking. And the first quarter was global deflation, global deflation, global deflation. And then after that, total crickets. Nobody talked about that anymore. And in the meantime, first it was gold, and then it was base metals. I've talked about base metals on your show. And then it was steel. And then I'm just kind of going through my list here. Every weekend, I go through like 35 ETFs and see which are trending up, which are trending down, and which are actually showing opportunities. And the only ones that I show that are trending down right now based on their 200-day moving average were a couple of the oil ETFs, which have popped up actually just over this past few days, corn and wheat and solar. I mean, and everything else is up above its 200-day moving average. So yes, this is very broad-based, and I think what it indicates is, even though nobody's talking about it, you know, the global deflation fears appear, at least by this particular metric, appear to have, you know, certainly abated, and maybe things are picking up globally, where you're getting copper and steel and base metals and some of these other commodity markets doing better. I think it bodes well for my bigger market call, which is by the end of this year, early next year, the S&P is going to be up an additional 10 to 15% from where we are right now. As long as the Brexit lows hold on this pullback that I'm expecting, you know, that's my kind of bigger picture looking in the early part of next year.
Well, just from a macro perspective, it's rather interesting because you have central banks now talking about helicopter drops. And if you look at this year's election, you know, you compare this John, to 2012 when we were talking about the sequester, when we were talking about budget deficits. Neither candidate is talking about that. In fact, they're all talking about spending major money, whether it's on infrastructure, defense, building out new government programs. Everybody's talking about spending money now and using basically the Fed to monetize it. So let's talk about interest rates. I want to get your take there, because we saw after Brexit, we saw the 10-year note get down to about 1.36. The market was expecting higher interest rates this year with the Fed rate hike. Now it's barely feasible that they'll even go in December, depending on some of this weak economic data. So what's your take on interest rates here? Where do you see them going?
My take in rates is oil's hit a nice bounce here. It's held support. As investors globally wrap their head around the fact that, commodity prices are starting to do better, global deflation isn't really a risk anymore. You may even get some people talking about inflation. The inflation numbers really haven't showed up as making any kind of a meaningful move higher yet, CPI or PCE. But, you see it in the commodity prices. You see it on a price basis. I think once that starts to permeate into the market, then the long end of the curve is going to start to reflect that. I mean, obviously, it's a forward-looking instrument. If you're looking at a 10-year, it's where inflation is going to be 10 years from now, where rate's going to be 10 years from now or 30 years from now. I'm looking at the CBOE 10-year Treasury Yield Index, which is a good yield surrogate and something, that I watch every day. My feeling is if we can stay up above 150 to 155 yield in the 10-year, it points to a move up to 188, 190. We get above 190, and now we're talking about we're up above the 200-day moving average. Bond yields are very, very technical. A lot of people don't talk about bond yields in technical terms, but I do. They're one of the most purely technical data series that I follow. So up in the low 150s, if we can hang in here, I think we're going to 190. And I'm kind of a macro strategist. So when I'm making a bond call, it has to kind of intersect with what I'm looking at for stocks, what I'm looking at for some of the commodity markets we talked about. And to me, if I'm looking for another 10 to 15% overall in the stock market by the early part of next year, then you can't have the yield of the 10-year going down to 1%. Some people think that would be bullish. No, that's bearish. I mean, if the Fed has to push rates lower, that's not bullish for the stock market, in my view. I mean, it may be immediately kind of knee-jerk effect bullish. Okay, more free money, yahoo, let's buy the stock market. But if you want a sustainable rise in the stock market, I think interest rates have to start to do better to indicate that the economy is doing better so that long rates can rise and maybe start to stave off a little bit of a puff of smoke from inflation here and there, and not that, the world is going into a black hole and we have to drive the 10-year down to 1%.
One thing that has been characteristic of this recovery, both in the economy and the markets, the rotations that we have seen, you talk about some of the rotations that you're seeing now, they only last 5 or 6 weeks. I can remember, you went back into the 80s and 90s when you had long-term trends in the market that lasted years. Now we're talking weeks. Doesn't this make it much more difficult for the average investor to navigate?
Ridiculously. Hey, you know what? It makes it more difficult for the professional to do. I've been doing this 30-some years, and it certainly made me better. I mean, again, I was just saying a couple of minutes ago, I'm a macro strategist that has gone back to my trading floor stock picking days, and now I'm picking ETFs and using stuff like ETF asset flows to find opportunities in steel or metals and mining ETFs, because the stock market's been flat for a year. It's much more difficult, and what I'm afraid of, and again, I work with a lot of financial advisors, and what these guys, clients, are scared to death of is another 08. And you see the complacency, and you see people, the market hasn't done anything in a year, so how come I'm not making any money, and what are you doing for me, asking their financial advisors. I think when people get really complacent, they forget about the risk side of this. And what I have seen just in the ETF asset flow work that I do is I've seen a lot of flows piling into spiders and Qs and IWM, which is the ETF for the Russell 2000, just within the past several weeks or so. It's kind of like Jenga. You know, if you stack too many blocks up top, all you got to do is make a little wiggle on that stack of blocks and the whole thing's going to be down and scattered all over your living room floor. I mean, that's what the market looks a little bit to me like now. People are like, I'm not making any money. I want to make money. You know, the heck with it. You know, let's just buy this. You know, let's buy a lot of it. Let's try to make more money. Let's buy these assets that are ETF two times, three times. The S&P went up 3%. If I buy a triple, then I'm up 9%. You know, people start to get squirrely when they're not making any money, and I'm afraid that that's partially what's going to trigger this pullback that I'm looking for into September.
You know, it's interesting. I follow fund flows like yourself. And given the fact that we have seen so many rapid rotations, and you saw, for example, last year, the stock market go nowhere. This year, it started down. It's amazing to see that money is coming out of active management and going into indexes, which it puzzles me in a market that rotates as much as it does.
Yeah, I can't speak to that. I mean, I don't know why that would happen. But you know, for me, if I see a sideways market and then I see a lot of money going in, I mean, obviously it ties directly into the VIX and the put-call ratio. If the market hasn't had a scare in a while, people have short-term memories and start to think, you know, they're bulletproof. And that's what I'm afraid is kind of going on here. But I'm hoping that some of the strength that I've seen in some of the commodity markets, oil has done really well here just over the last few weeks. Base metals, I mentioned steel. There's a whole bunch of them. I'm hoping that this pullback we get is not going to take those Brexit lows out, because that's a line in the sand for me for a lot of chart patterns. I've got chart patterns here. I talked about this the last time in the Dow. We had a breakout in the Dow back in April. We had a retest at the Brexit lows, which was June 27th. I've got the Dow going to 20,400. Russell, I'm just kind of looking at my screen here. I've got the Russell going to 1,400. We're trading at 1,235 now. So that's like a 14% rise from here. I've got individual stocks that I like. Here's one. Okay, Caterpillar. We bought Caterpillar back in July. I've got it going another 5% higher, $88 a share. I'm interested in CAT because it's positively correlated to the Dow Industrials. Tight and stable, you know, multi-year positive correlation to the Dow Industrials. Texas Instruments, bought that in May. I got that going. It's already up 17%, and I've got it going up another 8% to $75.50 a share. Why do I care about Texan? Positively correlated to the NDX, to the NASDAQ 100. The third one is Comcast. That's a relatively new buy for us. We bought that on May 13. I've got that going up another 12% to $75 a share. Comcast positively correlated to the S&P 500. So I think the common element of all these, the common question is, okay, where are you wrong? What happens if the market gets a shock somewhere? Yeah, I mean, geopolitically, it could happen anywhere. You know, for me, the line of the sand is those Brexit lows. We hold the Brexit lows, we could weather a pullback and still come up and hit these targets later on.
Final question, John. In all of this, your take on gold. You know, it's pulled back a little bit, but it's holding pretty firm here. Not much movement between 340, 360 range. How do you think gold performs here going forward?
Gold's been a funny one for me. I mean, I was on gold really early. On December 22nd, we wrote a piece on gold, and you and I have talked about it. It's Commitments of Traders Data. It's put out by the CFTC, and very simply, it shows how commercial hedgers are positioned in the futures market for a number of different futures markets, gold being one of them. Back at the end of December, these hedgers had basically lifted their hedges. They were effectively flat futures. They were short a little bit, but historically they were effectively had lifted their hedges. So that told me the smart guys thought that there was a really good buying opportunity down in gold, down at the December lows. So we caught that move and we got out in February, March. So we missed the second leg up that really started at the June lows and took us up to the July highs. And we've been kind of going sideways ever since. The reason that I didn't get back involved is those same hedgers are now as net short as they've been in 5 or 10 years. I don't like to fight those guys. Those guys are the insiders. They understand the market. they're not market timers. They are value finders. And when they think gold is overvalued, they put those hedges on hot in heaven. You see a huge net short position in the futures market. That means they're locking in their price at that level. So even if the gold that they're holding goes down, they pick that up on the other side in the short futures. So that's still what's going on now. So, you know, I don't like it that I didn't catch that second leg higher, but I'm not going to fight these hedgers. They're still holding an extreme net short. They're also holding one in platinum and silver. So you got the three that typically trade together, big net short positions by the hedgers. They think these markets are overvalued. So I like gold bigger picture, but I'm going to stay away from it for the near term and look to buy a really good break.
Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work at Asbury Research, how could they do so, please?
The best way is to visit the website. It's asburyresearch.com. There's a contact tab there. You could fill that out and say that you listened to the show today, and we will send you some sample reports. And we also have something relatively new. We have an individual investor package that is priced for an individual. We could send you sample reports there. We also have a service for financial advisors and hedge funds and, you know, various different levels of service. So that's one way to get a hold of us, or you can send an email to info@asburyresearch.com, or you can call us 888-960-0005, any one of those, and we will send you some free reports, give you some information about services and pricing.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Joining us on the show today is Art Berman. He's a well-known geological consultant. He's a director of Labyrinth Consulting Services and also a director of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas here in the U.S., also known as ASPO. And Art, as you know, oil is one of the most critical commodities for the functioning of our global economy and modern society. It's used for transportation, the making of plastics, rubber, and over 100 other items that we use on a continual basis. So with that said, we have seen a lot of volatility in the oil space over the past couple decades, at least going back even further. We can see large moves up and down, and we know that when oil went from as little as $10 in the late 90s to over $140 in 2008, people were really concerned about peak oil. But then we had the financial crisis in 2008. The price of oil collapsed down to $33 before rising eventually back to the $100 range. And just this year, it collapsed again down to as low as $26 a barrel when we look at the West Texas Intermediate crude contract. Given that oil has now remained in a much lower, though volatile range over this past year and a half, really since the beginning of 2015, the question I want to ask you, is peak oil no longer a concern, or has it simply been pushed out much further due to the shale boom?
I think that peak oil, it's one of those unfortunate terms that we're never going to get away from. But let's just talk about what I mean when I talk about peak oil. First of all, it has nothing to do with running out of oil. That's the first misconception. The world has an awful lot of oil in it. Nobody knows exactly how much we've used, but let's just say we may have used half of it, okay? Something, you know, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less. So peak oil is not about running out of oil. What peak oil is about is running out of affordable oil. So when people initially went exploring for oil and natural gas, just like anything else, gold, silver, you know, uranium, you name it, they're going to go after the easy stuff first. And if it's easy with oil and gas, that means it's shallow. That means it's relatively inexpensive to drill for and to produce. And the quality of it is probably pretty good. And so as you progressively work through consumption, the easy, cheap, good stuff, we're forced to drill deeper, use more technology, go offshore, and often start using oil that's of lower quality. And so basically what all that says is that by certainly the end of the 20th century, we as a world had pretty much gone through most of the easy, cheap stuff. And when oil starts costing more than it used to, then everything costs more than it used to. And the fact that we cannot seem as a world to get out of the economic doldrums that we're in right now, to me, is absolutely logical. No mystery in it at all. And I just told you the answer. Oil costs 3 or 4 times more than it did 20 years ago. And if everything, therefore, costs more to manufacture, transport, distribute, package, then guess what? The world's in trouble. The economy's in trouble because the cost of everything just went up. It's that simple. Now, obviously, there are complexities to it, but economists spend an awful lot of time worrying about things that usually don't include the cost and availability of energy, incredible as it seems. These are very intelligent people, don't get me wrong. I'm not being critical, but from what I read and know, very few economists consider the cost of resources or their availability in their models. So the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan and the People's Bank of China, they're all doing all this, you know, very esoteric kind of stuff to try to get the world economy growing again. And to me, I'm sure all that is good stuff. But if we don't address the fact that the master resource now costs 3 or 4 times as much as it did not very long ago, we're kind of picking around the edges. We're missing the main point and the main problem.
Well, just when we thought we were going to get a reprieve in terms of gasoline prices and oil is shooting back up towards $50 a barrel. It's been trading in an unusual pattern this year with new lows in almost nearly new highs on an annual basis. Joining us on the program is Kurt Wolf. And Kurt, how do we explain what happened to oil this year? I mean, if you try to take a look at where oil was in February, it was down to $26 a barrel. By the end of May, it was over $50 a barrel. It dropped right back down below 40. And here we are on this Friday, we're talking about $48. So how does one explain this, either technically or fundamentally?
Well, it's a bit of a wild ride. I don't know if I can explain it. I tend to be skeptical of the explanations. We can point to a lot of factors, but the truth is, you know, oil can go anywhere. And it showed on the way down. It went down farther than well below its fundamental value by my understanding. And now we're coming back to a more normal level. And even in the past just few weeks, it seems like people were saying that, oh, it's in a bear market, down 20%, and now a couple weeks later, oh, it's in a bull market, up 20%. Well, I don't know if anything really changed in that. It's fluctuations around the trend. It's a highly volatile commodity, but the underlying value is better, and I think we're definitely in an uptrend, and I'm holding to my $70 a barrel long-term number. I think that's good, and if you can buy stocks that make money at $70 a barrel, and just about all of them do, the oil and gas stocks make sense. Now, it's taken a while to get to the $70, but I think we'll get there yet.
Kurt, what is your long-term forecast for that number? Is this something that happens in the next couple of years that you see that number being realized?
Well, I used to say by the end of last year, and then I said by the end of this year. By the end of this year, it's still possible. But the more time you take, the stronger the case should become. But, of course, we don't really know the future. And there's a lot of political uncertainty around the world. There's great monetary uncertainty. We've got negative interest rates in many countries. We have, in the U.S., the yield on the 10-year TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Security, is bumping right along the zero line. It's up slightly positive now. It's been slightly negative recently. But anything less than 10 years in the TIPS market or inflation-adjusted market is negative. So when we have negative rates, they don't last too long, and they're ultimately followed by a bit of inflation and hopefully some growth and a good market for oil. Good conditions for gold, good conditions for real assets, and oil is certainly a great real asset.
And, you know, when you look at this, there's been various numbers that have been used over the years in terms of what the break-even point is for oil, whether you're talking about shale oil, and of course you have to look at the different shale basins. Then you talk about offshore oil. Recently, there was a report that offshore oil production was increasing in the Gulf of Mexico. What's a realistic number that you think these companies can make money? Because you look at a lot of the majors and the mid-tiers and even the small companies. What's a realistic number?
Well, there is a lot of talk about that, and companies do talk about that. They have to have that in mind when they make investments. And, of course, there are two numbers. One number for some people might call all-in. That is where you count all of your cost and where you'd make a decision as whether or not to embark on a new project. And then there's the incremental price. You know, incrementally, it doesn't cost a lot to get the oil out of the ground if you already have the oil. But if you don't have the oil and you need to develop it, it can be fairly expensive. But let's talk about some numbers. You know, presumably, the economics are very sensitive to how good a project you have. If you've got a huge discovery, it tends to be economic at some fairly low level. So on the offshore, if Exxon's got a really big multi-billion dollar discovery offshore Suriname, I think it is, in South America, and if the government taxes are reasonable, they can make good money on that prospect around a little better than the current prices, $50, $60 or so. The shale guys, I think if you're talking the Bakken trend in North Dakota, I think the companies want $50 or more for an extended period before that volume goes up again. We're getting some lower numbers in the Permian Basin of West Texas, where Cimarex and EOG and Pioneer will say they can make money on their best fields, at least on their best fields, in the $40 a barrel range. So we're right at the point where, you know, we had a couple of weeks where the rigs went up a small amount. The companies don't know the future any better than the rest of us, but they want to see a stable price of $50 or better to really increase activity.
You know, this is something that I wonder if you might address. A lot of these companies have cut back on expenditures, literally tens of billions of dollars. There's hundreds of thousands of jobs that have been lost as companies contract, cut back on spending, and also cut back on employment. And the problem with that, Kurt, as you know, when you're trying to replace your reserves, I think the report last year is 70% of reserves are being replaced for the majors right now. And as you say, companies aren't about to, let's say the price of oil spiked up to $50 as it looks like it's doing now, they're not about to embark on new spending programs for something that is short-term or temporary, as we've seen this year. We've hit 50 before, but we went straight down.
Yeah, my wife likes to say once burned, twice shy. And the oil companies did start up a little bit last year, and then the price went down again and went down a lot. So there's a real reluctance to become too aggressive yet. So if we say that companies will spend more money at 50, that doesn't necessarily mean we're in a healthy industry situation yet. It'll take more. And of course, once you start bringing back some of these crews that have been laid off and hiring the service companies again, their prices are going to go up. They're down a lot right now, but they'll go up as they need to expand again.
The thing that really struck me, and especially when we got down to 26 and then went right back up over 50, is how vulnerable this market is. Just geopolitical or natural risk, we saw a million barrels come offline with the Canadian oil sands. We saw almost close to a million come off with Nigeria for geopolitical reasons. It just goes to show you how vulnerable this market is. But, Kurt, don't you think one of the things that weighs on higher oil prices is the amount of inventory that's in storage now, either in storage facilities or on ships?
Yeah, we have enough inventory, so there's no crisis if there's some production loss temporarily. So the inventories are high, storage tanks are full, and normally that means that it's a damper on prices. On the other hand, if you think the price is going up, carrying a little extra inventory is not a bad idea.
And so when we look at this oil market, and of course it fluctuates a lot, I never did understand the trading around these inventory numbers that are reported every week, because a lot of this, Kurt, as you know, is just estimates.
Yeah, that's right. The numbers aren't all that accurate, but you could actually see the price move when the number comes out. Those are probably computers who are programmed to do that. Who knows?
Yeah, because when the numbers come out, it's not like somebody's out there with a dipstick and they're measuring the oil. A lot of these are based on estimated figures, and it's kind of like the government figures that we get on the economy. You know, you get the first print, and then they go back and they revise it two or three times. And so, in many ways, it's a false sense of analysis if you're using these numbers because you want to look at longer-term trends. I want to talk about companies specifically. We have seen with the drop of oil that a lot of companies have pared back their investments. They've cut the amount of employees that are working. They're not replacing their reserves. But a lot of these companies have gone on record. In fact, they've made an emphasis on this, that the dividends are going to be maintained. It's very important for a lot of these companies that, you know, they've gone out, we're going to do everything to protect that dividend. How safe do you think, if we stay in this range, let's say the $40, $50, $60 range, how safe are the dividends of the big companies?
Well, they're rock solid safe at Exxon, and they're practically just as safe at Chevron. The dividends are considerably less than cash flow at these prices. They were even less than cash flow when we were down at a $30 and $25 price. So those dividends are very solid. The dividends on Royal Dutch and Total, European companies, are higher, and they could be a little bit vulnerable if we had really difficult industry conditions. They're solid too, not quite to the same degree as Exxon and Chevron. Those are the big dividend payers.
Yeah, there's been some recent stories on companies like Royal Dutch. Barron's did a story that they're restructuring the company. They're emphasizing shareholder returns, which they're saying they're going to do everything they can to maintain that dividend. They're selling off properties. They're restructuring, paring down their debt. So you have a lot of companies doing that. But once again, it depends on the price. Is there anything that you see that could drive the price down low, like we saw in February this year, where I think it was overdone? There was a fear over what was happening in China, economic growth globally. But Kurt, as you know, I read the figures from the IEA every year, oil consumption goes up. If somebody in China buys a car, you now have a new oil consumer. So what are the risks to the oil market that it can go lower? Because, you know, I saw a gentleman on the financial channel today that says oil's going down to $20 and $30 a barrel. For the life of me, I'd like to know why.
Well, anything can happen, I say, but it wouldn't stay there for very long. And we've already proven that just this year. I think if you really talk about big numbers, you're talking about the economic situation. If we have economic growth, oil prices go up. If we have inflation, oil prices go up. We might have deflation. If we have deflation, that's when economic activity contracts. And under those circumstances, you can see low prices for everything. But that's a condition that could happen. We had it briefly in the 30s. That's why you keep some cash reserves, so that you can have buying power when the stocks are down, or so that you can survive when your stock market is. But that's a really gloomy case. And so central banks have been doing their best to avoid that. They've created a lot of money. I think it's more likely we're going to have, well, I mean, ideally, being a positive guy, an optimistic guy, I think we're going to have better economic growth. And we might have inflation, but we probably won't have deflation. So those are the three possibilities. And so those are the economic conditions. They tend to overwhelm any particular industry conditions.
And Kurt, as you look at the companies that you follow large cap, mid cap, and some of the smaller tier exploration companies. You evaluate companies on your MacDep ratio. What looks like bargain areas to you today? Is it the large cap, the mid cap, the small cap, or is it universal that these companies still remain undervalued?
It's a mix. Some of the really quality companies like Cimarex and EOG have MacDep ratios above one, which means that they're undervalued relative to the other, but they're still very nice growing companies. On a pure value, and then of course there are some companies that have too much debt, you could only play with them if you looked at it as an option rather than as a stock. But there are other very solid companies that are lagging behind. Of course, I think Exxon is still a cheap stock. I have a MacDep ratio of 0.9 on it, but it's done well. The charts are good on most of these stocks. Marathon has picked up quite a bit lately. I had a 0.83 MacDep ratio. ConocoPhillips hasn't gone anywhere yet. This chart doesn't look that good, but it's got a 0.73 MacDep ratio, so it's the real value. My lowest MacDep ratios are for the income payers, the royalty trusts out there. They don't have any debt, but they tend to go up and down quite a bit, probably in an exaggerated sense. And the income payers that I cover also tend to have a royalty interest rather than a working interest, so that they're all in a Permian Basin to some extent. So when Cimarex and the EOG and Pioneer spend money to drill horizontal wells in a Permian Basin, even at low oil prices, these are royalty trusts, not necessarily everyone and not to the full extent, but they benefit. They get a participation in that oil without having to put up any capital. And then they get paid from revenue off the top. They don't have to bear the operating expenses in a true royalty sense. So they're very high quality plays, but they're small and they're not well understood. They've come back quite a bit already, but I think they're still my cheapest stocks. They have a McDepp ratio of 0.64 for the median of the group, where a McDepp ratio of 1 is what the properties might be worth at $70 oil. And so at 0.64, there's quite a bit of upside yet. They pay a high dividend, but the dividends are variable. The dividends are very secure in the sense that if the price is there, the dividends are paid. If the price isn't there, they don't pay the dividends. You have to appreciate that those distributions will go up and down with price. That's the risk, but it's also the opportunity.
Yeah, one of the things that I've noticed with a lot of these royalty trusts, they're thinly traded. And a lot of times when, you know, let's say oil prices go up and there's a demand for income, because people know if oil prices go up, that dividend's going to go up. These stocks can get bid up and almost become parabolic. But likewise, if the price drops, they can drop like lead. So there's a little bit of a trading risk there.
That's right. I think they're solid entities, but the price is volatile. And they're not that big. They're thinly traded, so we shouldn't talk about them too much. But, you know, Marathon and ConocoPhillips are big companies. They're not quite as cheap, but, you know, if you can afford to wait for them to do better, because the alternative is you don't make any money on a money fund these days.
Kurt, what about companies that actually are growing? Because it's like anything else. If I'm looking at a company, I don't care if it's a consumer staple or a technology company like Apple, you're looking at companies that can grow their top line. And in the oil business, growing the top line is a reflection of production, increasing your production. What companies have a strong production profile? Because if the oil price does turn around, as many suspect it will, then those companies that have the strongest production profile of increasing production are the companies can do very well in that kind of market in a turnaround.
My best buy recommendations on companies with growth are Continental Resources and Birchcliff, the Canadian company. Now, I don't have buy recommendations on high-quality companies like Cimarex and EOG, but they certainly have growth prospects. The smaller the company, the more likely it is growing.
And you and I have talked about this in the past, but when you take a company, whether it's Exxon, it's a Royal Dutch, or it's a large mega cap company that's not replacing its reserve. Last year, 70% of reserves were replaced. If the oil market turns around, you know, it's still, in my opinion, especially with some of these McDepp ratios as low as you are reporting them, that one of the easiest ways to replace reserves is just go out and simply buy them on Wall Street. But we haven't really seen much of that.
No, we've seen individual property transactions. And the company Birchcliff I just mentioned did a wonderful deal where they bought properties that were right in the heart of what they're already doing. And Canada was under pressure to sell, so the timing was wonderful. The Birchcliff was somewhat of a high-debt company, but then when they bought these properties, they bought them in May, and they did a stock offering for the full value of the properties, which had they gave them the automatic financing, and it reduced their overall leverage. So this is not what you're saying. You're thinking, why doesn't Exxon buy these companies? But it turns out that Birchcliff was the one that did the good deal here. Cimarex and the EOG make a big point of growing from within, but that could be targets for a big company if they want to get some growth.
I keep thinking somebody like an EOG, because the big companies, I mean, they don't buy small properties, they don't buy small companies, because, you know, when you're that large, it doesn't have that much of an impact. So I'm just thinking, you know, going back to the last downturn in oil at the end of the 90s, you had Texaco bought out, Exxon bought Mobil, and so they went after the bigger play.
Yeah, that's worked out. Then when Exxon bought Cross Timbers and ConocoPhillips bought Burlington Resources, those were both natural gas-oriented companies, and they caught the top of the gas market in 2006, 2007, and so on. So they've been burned a little bit by making acquisitions lately, anyway.
Well, Kurt, as you look at the market right now, as you see things, would you be adding, buying energy at this point? Would you hold back and wait for, let's say, a pullback? Or what's your take if you were an investor right now?
Well, I think you should have a significant portfolio representation in energy. If you don't have much, you should be buying right now. if you're satisfied with your position, you can stick with it or try to optimize it a little bit. But I think a solid position in energy, maybe an overweighted position in energy, is what makes a lot of sense right here. I'm very comfortable with it.
Well, listen, Kurt, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, why don't you give out your website, if you would?
Sure. It's McDepp.com. McDepp is spelled M-C-D-E-P, like David Edward Peter. It's my analytical ratio. The lower the McDepp ratio, the more undervalued the company. But there are also some qualifications, and I have 15 years worth of research on my website that you can access at McDepp.com.
Well, if we said it once, we said it a million times. Here we are in silly season, and most of the political coverage is concentrated on trivia and tit-for-tat spatting between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. He said this, she said that, he said this, she said that. You know, the big issues that are going to affect the presidency for the next 4 years, they're not generally on the table for discussion. So what we're going to do in the big picture today is talk about those issues which our candidates need to be discussing, and hopefully they will address during the debates. It's things such as the Middle East, the war on terror, the deficit and the debt, the staggering economy, and why people feel we're headed in the wrong direction. All of that coming up next on the Financial Sense News Hour and the Big Picture at financialsense.com.